This podcast is supported by The Real Real.
You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the founder and the host of the Rise Above Justice Movement and the Rise Above Justice Movement, the podcast. Today, I am joined by Joe and Vanessa. Today, we will be covering a very harrowing, complex story of Megan Trussell. And I would like to give a viewer discretion as advised due to the nature of the topics that we'll be discussing. Joe and Vanessa, welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. It is an honor to sit down and talk with both of you. So Joe, if you want to kick us off, you know, tell us who you are, and then Vanessa will bring you in just a moment after Joe finishes.
Well, first off, thank you for having us. We really appreciate you having us on your show and the platform that you're providing, because the more exposure we can get about the case, the better. So it's people like you who are making a difference, and we truly appreciate it. I'm Joe Trussell. I'm Megan's dad. God, what is there to say? Live in Denver, Colorado, originally from Louisiana, been out here for about 30 years. Had a really close relationship with Megan. And as you can imagine, it's like having a second full-time job trying to meet the two goals that we have, which are to exonerate Megan's name because she did not take her own life, and to find out who did, because we don't want another family to have to go through this if they don't have to.
Absolutely. Thank you, Joe. Vanessa, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, I am Vanessa Diaz. I am Megan Trussell's mother. I'm a native to Colorado. And I just want to reiterate what Joe said. Thank you so much for having us on your podcast and for giving us your platform and letting us share the story. It's been an extremely traumatic process, and we just want to get the word out there. And the more people who know the inconsistencies in the investigation and the holes, the better. Because I think that's what it's going to take to have some movement in this investigation is the people out there who agree and want justice for Megan.
Absolutely. You know, and I created the Rise Above Justice Movement because I saw a need and amplifying stories exactly like Megan's. And some of the other stories that I've covered, they tend to go very deep and tend to go very complex, because we know that these issues across the country are very complex, and it's not easy to sit down and talk about it. And the courage that both of you have is beyond inspiring. You know, and I wish we would have met under different circumstances, but I'm glad that we have connected, because both of you embody the spirit of Megan. And based on what I know so far, just by talking to Rebecca, who runs the social media, I believe that's her name, right, Vanessa?
Yes.
Okay. I just want to make sure. I talk to a lot of people, so getting names, you know, correct is obviously not the easiest thing, but based on what I understand, Megan was like this advocate and like advocated for people that are marginalized and, you know, understood the complexity of issues facing our communities. And I would love for, you know, either one of you can kind of start off, but walk me through some of those inconsistencies of what you noticed with this case, because this was not investigated by and municipal. This was investigated by the sheriff's office, correct?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. So walk us through some of those inconsistencies and then kind of like what led up to this and like who Megan was. And I know I'm throwing a lot of questions, but you can just kind of break it up however you want to and just kind of let this conversation free flow.
Yeah, sure. Gee, there's so many things it's hard to figure out where to start. I guess first off is who Megan was. She was an incredibly intelligent and creative person, a very kind soul who made everybody feel like you were her favorite person. She had a lot of interests, and she also had a things that she was adamantly against, and she wasn't afraid to name those things. She was who she was, and she made no apologies. She expressed herself by changing her hair color and through the music that she listened to. She was a bass player. And she's deeply, deeply missed in our family. Yesterday was my grandnephew's third birthday party, and nothing is the same without Megan. What do you want to add, Joe?
Yeah, Megan was she was cool. She was like Vanessa said, she was a bass player. She was also a sketch artist. So she was very artistically minded and really knew how to express herself. As Vanessa said, she was a very unique young lady. She was really on her own path, and her mom and I promoted that and supported that because we knew she was destined for great things. Because she didn't follow the trend, she didn't follow the normal path. You know, she had her vintage CD collection, which I thought was hilarious. She loved to play the bass. She loved all kinds of different music. She was a film expert. We watched a million movies together. She was just a great young lady with a really bright future. She was really she, at CU, University of Colorado, where she was going to school. She was really kind of blooming, blossoming into the person she was going to become. And it was a joy to watch, until it wasn't. What else? She was my bud. We watched a lot of movies together. We enjoyed each other's company. So, kind of to switch gears, when she went missing, when we realized that there was something wrong, I'm jumping ahead here, but she was not a self-harm person. She was not a self-medicating person. She was very secure in herself, very secure about being Megan, and she never had any ideations of that sort before the Boulder County Sheriff tried to convince us that she had taken her own life, which is not the case. I don't know what else, Vanessa.
I guess we can. Are you ready for us to jump into the inconsistencies, or
Yeah, feel free to jump into some of the inconsistencies that, not only you've noticed, but we've all noticed that have been following this case. I remember hearing about this back in February, like right after it happened. I looked over at my partner and I literally just kind of, I just felt a sense of like what they were reporting is not correct, like literally at all. There are so many inconsistencies in this. And I've been doing this for so long, and I've heard stories that are similar to this. And it always turns out that there's obviously foul play that's obviously involved. And the points, the facts lead directly to that. This was not a suicide. And I, as somebody who's been suicidal, as somebody who's been through a drug addiction, somebody who's, a survivor of sexual assault and domestic violence, I see a lot of flaws in our systems. And know how many times police jump automatically directly to, oh, it's a suicide. They wring their hands and they move on.
yeah, that's what we found. It's
Oof.
as part of this process, we pore over the CUPD, University of Colorado Police reports, as well as the Boulder County Sheriff reports. And we got a trove of video that Vanessa had requested from Boulder County Sheriff. And just kind of to give you a little vignette here, we were unhappy with the detective from the get-go. He seemed kind of dismissive of our questions, and we ended up meeting with the sheriff on March 10th to talk about that. And the sheriff listened to us, and we basically voiced our concerns for about 40 minutes, and then I said, "Enough of us talking. Why don't you tell us what you think?" And he said, "Based on the evidence that I've seen, I don't believe a crime was committed." So that's when we knew, or that's when I knew that that we were up against something different. So the next day we had an interview, and I should go back. The detective, we were talking to him the prior week, and he was saying what he was doing and what he was following up on. And I said, "I have a question for you." And he said, "Yeah, shoot." I said, "Why haven't you interviewed me?" And he said, "Why would I interview you?" And I said, "Because I'm Megan's father. And if you're leaning towards a suicide ruling, don't you want to know about her past, her history, what kind of person she was, if she had ever had any suicidal ideations?" And he said, "Do you want me to interview you?" And I said, "Yes." So we arranged to have this interview, which was the day after we met with the sheriff. So my point is, I went back and watched the video that we just got of our interview with the detective. It's about an hour and a half long. There's not a whole lot new there, except the detective says, "I follow the evidence. I do not, have any preconceived ideas about what this was. I'm looking only at the evidence. So anybody who says it's a suicide, it's way too early to even make that determination." We said, "Okay, we'll believe you on that." Well, that night, we had found out that the shoe was missing, which we'll get to, and that her phone was missing. They had recovered the purse. And Vanessa posted a plea for help on Facebook, asking anybody who might have seen the shoe or anybody who had any information about the phone, to please get in touch with us. The next morning, the Boulder County Sheriff's Office put out a press release in which they said, "There is no harm to the community, and we believe there is no foul play involved." So that detective lied to our faces. I have it on video where he lied to our faces about what they thought it was. So to me, that's proof that from the get-go, 3 weeks after Megan was found, or under 3 weeks, they had already decided that it was a suicide. And everything that they did from that point forward was to bolster their hypothesis, which is horseshit. Excuse the language, but as we go back and as I kind of sift through all this evidence, and Vanessa does, and we have other people who are helping us as well, we find more and more inconsistencies. We find proof that they were calling this a suicide from the moment they found her, or maybe before, which is extremely irritating, as you can imagine. But it also tells me that we're on the right track. So I'm kind of rambling. But that's been on my mind the past couple of days, because twists and turns every single day it seems like with this case. But we try to focus our energy, and that's just something that popped up I think on Friday that I noticed, and I'm like, there he is. He lied to us. Not the first lie, but just the latest that we found.
Yeah. So, this fight that we're on, the first part of it is to have the suicide ruling questioned and overturned. Unfortunately, in Colorado, as in many, many states, it's only the coroner who can make that determination. So, looking at research, and just, knowing Megan, and no, Megan's smart. When she first started taking Adderall for her ADHD, and this was, of course, during the pandemic, and kids were online, and it's really hard to focus. She dealt with it pretty well when she was going to school every day, but once it was virtual, and as she grew up, she noticed that she could use a little help. So we went ahead and got her prescription for Adderall. She'd been taking it. She started her freshman year in high school, so she'd been taking it for 4 years. She knew the risks with Adderall. She knew, that there's a shortage of it for a couple years there, where we had to call different clinics or pharmacies just to get it filled, her prescription filled. And nobody's stockpiling Adderall. So when the coroner and the forensic pathologist, actually, she's the one who made the recommendation. She sees this, what somebody had described to us somewhere at one point, that it was a massive amount of pill material in her stomach and esophagus, the size of a softball. Well, when Joe and I heard that, we were like, nobody has that much out. What else is it? Well, when toxicology came back, all she had in her system was amphetamine, and Cotinine, which is, she vaped. That's all that was in her system, in her blood. So what the heck else is all of this other stuff, In a meeting with the forensic pathologist and the coroner and these people, where they finally were giving us an opportunity to ask questions, like, what's your narrative? What's your story? How did she die? Right? How is this a suicide? It was uncovered that they didn't test the stomach and esophagus contents. They eyeballed it on a visual guess, not even looking into, does anybody stockpile Adderall? Right? Like, if somebody who'd never had any history of suicidal ideation, self-harm, substance abuse, she wasn't stockpiling Adderall for this weird night event to happen, to overdose on that. And not only that, she didn't have enough to be a lethal level in her system. In fact, it might not even be a toxic level for for someone who's been taking it, for 4 years, and her dosage had been increasing. It started at 10 milligrams of extended release, and it was her end prescription was for 25 milligrams of extended release. So we asked, did you test it? No, they didn't. Then I asked, did you even keep it? Or is this just we're relying on your guess, your assumption? And no, I mean, they did save it. They saved a bit of it. Joe's analogy is like they saved a marble of a softball.
Yeah,
And
they said it
that's
was a softball size mass, or we've heard that at one point, but yeah, they tested a marble of that softball.
Yeah. So once they sent that in, and because I was sure there had to be something else, some other toxic substance in that mix. Well, according to NMS Labs, it was all amphetamine, Adderall, 1.7 million nanograms. And I know people's eyes gloss over when I start talking numbers, but this is really important because that's 1.7 million nanograms. That's a tiny, like, nanograms are what, a millionth of a gram? Or is that a thousandth? Now I'm getting my numbers
Thousand,
confused.
I don't
It's a
know,
thousandth of, yeah,
fractions.
fractions, yes. Either way, when you break down the numbers, it's a small percentage of whatever else is in that 35 milliliters that they sent in for testing. It's like, if it's a 100-piece puzzle, the whole thing, right? And you only have five pieces. That's Adderall. What's the rest of it? And the forensic pathologist specifically said in that meeting with us that based on the sheer volume of pill material in her stomach and esophagus, so much that the lumen in her esophagus was distended and basically stuck there, right? That's why she said it was a volitional, an act of volition, like she meant to kill herself. Well, right there alone is so many questions, right? Like, why was it stuck in her throat? We asked, did was it was that coming back up, or was it stuck going down? They didn't test that. They don't know. She has bruising on her face. She has broken teeth. She has abrasions on the inside of her mouth. How can you just assume, because she's got this lump in her throat of something that's not even all Adderall, who knows what it is, because they didn't test for anything else besides drugs and whatever else comes up on toxicology. And not at least think, is it a possibility that somebody staged this to look like a suicide, that somebody put this in her body? How can you not even wonder? You know, like instead, they're making this big leap based on assumptions and bias that she put this in her own body, that she did this to herself, and that's why it had to be a suicide.
Yeah, there's a, I look at it kind of from the maybe pragmatic, practical side of things, or like the mechanisms of what happened. So she was found way up in Boulder Canyon, which is what, I don't know, 4.5, 5 miles from her dorm room, Vanessa.
3 miles.
3 miles, sorry. 3 miles from her dorm room. It's pitch black up there at night, and it was sub-freezing. So she left her dorm room, and they say she walked across campus. The last place she was seen on camera was next to the stadium on CU's campus, and then she's not seen again. But we're expected to believe that she walked in the pitch black darkness out of the campus and up into Boulder Canyon, which is a known place for unhoused people and for drug use and for crime. It's a place that CU students are advised not to visit after dark. I mean, it's got a bike path and all that kind of stuff that people use during the day. But that she walked up this pitch black bike path and then crawled down off the bike path into a really creepy culvert. It's about 4 feet tall. And walked the length of this pitch black culvert, which is full of unhoused people's detritus, sleeping bags, hypodermic needles, bottles of urine, pallets. She traversed this and came out the other side, and then laid down on the rocks or fell down on the rocks and died. None of that makes any sense. As I've said, Megan used to get, she was not a hiker. She was not an outdoors person. I mean, we used to take trips where we would go to mountains and national parks and stuff, and she would participate, but that was not her jam. She was more of a crawl up in bed kind of person. So none of that makes any sense. And we believe that there's no way she could have found her way there on her own. She had never been in Boulder Canyon in the daytime or the darkness. So it,
And their timeline, by the way, their timeline makes it sound like she had to have left her dorm. When she left campus, she made a beeline and she knew exactly where she was going and she was walking at a pretty brisk pace, which, I mean, the timeline, according to what they've presented in their reports, sounds like it's doable. But, you know, I know I've walked many, many miles with Megan, and I did the walk myself, and I actually went with my niece Rebecca and my sister, and they were walking more at Megan pace, and I'm like, come on, because I don't, you know, I just wanted to see if it could be done, and that's because I knew exactly where I was going. Megan, when you look at the videos of her walking through campus, before she left campus that night, she wasn't looking at her phone. She wasn't wiping away tears. She didn't look distraught. She was just walking like her regular self, not overly fast, but how did she get there? You know, and how did, like, all the cameras that were along that the stretch of road that they think she went on, none of them picked her up. Like, there are cameras everywhere, right?
yeah, it's
How did,
Boulder. It's
yeah.
they call it the People's Republic of Boulder because you're always being watched, because Boulder prides itself on being a safe space. So there are cameras everywhere.
And CUPD, by the way, they, Detective Acock, I just want to shout her out here because after reading reports, she was the only one who actually seemed like she was trying to do something, who actually was operating out of concern, not just
Yeah, not just
bias,
procedural. Yeah.
procedural. And well, and beyond procedural, you know, some of those reports where they start out with one of the CUPD detectives said that she was meandering and looked distraught. And when I watched the videos, she does absolutely not look distraught. And why is that something that you put in a report? Why is that necessary? You know, except for building up to their narrative about what happened to her, so they could just write it off. You know, this poor little Latina girl was just so upset. You know, she found her way up to this really dangerous spot and took all of her Adderall. And here's the thing, she actually died of hypothermia. And this was before that could even be absorbed into her system. Now let that sit in. Like, who takes a stimulant, an amphetamine, and then just lays down and freezes to death? Joe and I have had to build a really thick skin that we can talk about our daughter in this way, right? But that's we have to say this so that people can hear the absurdity of this narrative. Like once again, I go back to the forensic pathologist in the coroner's office did no research into Adderall, into this medication. You can't even find any research or any cases of people overdosing on only Adderall. It doesn't happen. I think Megan will probably be the first one if they don't change the suicide ruling, because it's not a suicide. And if they're saying it is a suicide, just based on the sheer volume of pill material, they need to change it. So that and then that's my whole point. That was a long way to get to it, but my argument is that they based it purely on the volume of pill material, and it's not pill material. So then you need to change your decision. The same forensic pathologist, Dr. Meredith Frank, she I found some, because that's all we do now. Joe and I just do research, read reports, try to dig stuff up, right? So that we can create an argument to get these things changed. Well, I found a case where it was a court case, and Dr. Frank was supervising another forensic pathologist, and she stated that she would not call something a homicide unless she was 99.9% sure. Why doesn't she have that same standard for suicide? Because there's no way, unless Megan left a note, which there's no note anywhere. Her phone was wiped. She didn't write anything in any of her notebooks at school. There's nothing on any apps that she was using. There's no note. Like, they don't even know if she was the last one to touch the bottles. You know why? They didn't test for fingerprints or DNA on the bottles. In fact, they did no forensic testing on anything. They didn't
Nothing.
check for anything that they didn't want to find that might point away from suicide. I mean, literally nothing. When I talk to people who were in law enforcement or previously in law enforcement, and they're like, "Well, what came back when they did when they did forensic testing on whatever?" I mean, there's a list of things that they collected,
And
but they never
raped it.
sent in. Yeah, like the pants that were under her body that they assumed were hers, not hers. They're size small. They're also filthy. Do they look for trace DNA on that? No. Did they even ask us if it was hers? No. They
Yeah,
should at
and
least make sure all of that stuff was even Megan's, right? Shouldn't Megan's fingerprints be on those bottles? They tested
yeah,
nothing.
the I'm still hung up on that interview with the detective, but he said in that interview, what my hope is, and I'm paraphrasing, is to provide a narrative based on the evidence that we get to tell you, with as much accuracy as we can, what we believe happened. So on the day that that we had the meeting with the Boulder County Sheriff on May 27th, they basically said, it's a suicide. Thank you for your time. No narrative, nothing to back up anything that they believed. There's nothing in the reports to back up anything that they're saying here. So, I mean, it's just they pulled it out of thin air because nothing points to suicide.
No. So the other thing is that it's a mismatch for them to say that it's hypothermia and that you can die from suicide, that you can commit suicide by hypothermia, right? Because the symptomology of hypothermia in itself means that you lose touch with reality, you can hallucinate. Here's just a theory, right? I don't think this is what happened, but it's a theory. So she's out there. She's doesn't know how she got where she got. She's lost. She's confused. Somehow, in the midst of the hypothermia, thinking irrationally, she's like, "You know what? Adderall makes me warm. What if I take my Adderall and warm up?" Right? Well, that's not trying to die. That's actually trying to warm up. So they don't know why she took that medicine. They don't know how it got in her body. They don't know anything. So you can't say definitively that it was a suicide just for the sheer fact that it was hypothermia.
Yeah, I asked Dr. Frank when we had a meeting with the coroner and Dr. Meredith Frank, the forensic pathologist, and I said, okay, some guy's on a beach, gets drunk, swims out in the middle of the ocean, and drowns. Is that a suicide? And she said, well, does he have a lethal amount of alcohol in his system? And I said, Megan didn't have a lethal amount of Adderall in her system. And she didn't have an answer for that. So it doesn't hold water. It doesn't work. Her hypothesis, and the fact that she can make this assumption and offer her quote unquote opinion on what happened is not fair to us. It's not fair to Megan. It's not fair to that community because there's somebody out there who's responsible for this. And if the police or the Boulder County Sheriff, they have an oath to protect the public. They are not following their oath. This is an incomplete investigation, period. You can take all of our emotion out of it, all of our heartbreak, anything about Megan, whatever. At the core, they did not do a complete investigation, and we deserve a complete investigation, period. That's it.
Great.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to recognize the courage that both of you have and the how incredibly difficult this is to share. But I know I am taking notes on this because I want to continue, amplifying the efforts that you all are doing because I believe obviously in justice, but I also believe that our police departments can do a whole lot better. And I grew up in Missouri. But I live in Kansas now, so I'm just one state over from you all. And I have friends that live in the Denver area, and I have friends that live in Colorado and different parts of Colorado. And I see the story literally everywhere. And I'm glad that it is because it deserves to be. Every story deserves to be. But we know how mainstream media likes to spin these stories. And I read a couple articles that it kind of makes you like scratch your head a little bit. Because you sit back and you're like, that's not what that, yeah, no, there's a lot of inconsistencies, even with like the media reporting, because they spin it in their own way, right?
Yeah, and that's something we've had to, we're learning all this on the fly. This is all DIY. But yeah, that's a good point. I mean, we don't have any control over what the media reports, right? I mean, we can provide our story, we can provide the evidence that we have, and pretty much once it's out there, it's somebody else's decision. I will say that we've had some really wonderful support from some mainstream media. There are other organizations out there who are a bit more salacious and are looking for an angle and are not really following the actual narrative of the case. But kind of goes back to Vanessa saying, we need a thick skin. We have an extreme level of detachment as far as the details of the case, and we have to have that same detachment when it comes to the media. Sometimes you get a good story, sometimes you don't. As far as law enforcement, I've always had respect for law enforcement. I'm the son of an army colonel. I've always kind of had a respect for authority, even though I ran from the cops like when I was a teenager, like everybody else. or maybe not everybody else, but I certainly did. But I've always had a level of respect for them. And one of the kind of heartbreaking things for me as I go back and read my notes, I've been keeping a daily or try to keep a daily kind of diary of everything that's happened. And I went back last week and started reading through some of it. And I think on February 18th, 17th, 18th, we were assigned this detective. And I wrote in my notes, I feel really good about this guy. He sounds like the kind of person who's he's a professional and he's going to take this and he's going to find out what happened. But as things moved along, it became glaringly obvious that that wasn't going to be the case. In talking with law enforcement friends, I'm got friends kind of all over the place, and I'm from Louisiana, and I've got a good dear old friend who's a sergeant with Baton Rouge Homicide. And talking to him, he read through the reports, and he said, these guys need to stick to finding stolen bicycles. He said, this is one of the most incomplete, incoherent reports I've ever seen on a suspicious death. You know, so it, you know, it's I still have respect for law enforcement. However, in this case, these guys have just let us down. I don't know how else to put it. You know, it's like, here it is, do your job, find out what happened. And they just fumbled. And that, you know, their whole thing is, this is our narrative and we're going to do anything to protect it. And they have this attitude of, you know, like, let the adults talk. We're the professionals. Well, you're not very professional if you're not doing your job, you know? So, you know, frustrating, but the thing is, I mean, Vanessa can attest to this. We are grieving parents, but we're not weak and we're not stupid. And we're not going to be pushed away and we're not going to quit. You know, I told Detective Robinson before our meeting, that momentous meeting that we had on March 11th. I had gotten there a little bit before Vanessa. And he said, tell me a little bit about Vanessa. And I said, she's relentless. You need to know that. And he said, oh, I know. And I said, I don't think you do. she's relentless. We're going to get to the bottom of this, you know, but they severely underestimated our resolve, because we're supposed to take what they say and just go grieve, I guess. And that's just not what happened. And Megan deserves better. And the students who are in school there deserve better. And that community deserves better than a lazy sheriff's department.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, what type of student was Megan? Like, what was she studying? What was her, like, future aspirations? Like, what was she wanting to do as, like, career-wise? Or did she participate in any, like, extracurricular activities or anything like that?
Well, she was a bass player. And I tell a funny story. When she was a junior in high school, I said, Megan, it's about time for you to start thinking about where you want to go to school. And she said, it doesn't really matter where I go to school. I'm only going to college because there might be bands that need bass players. I was like, yes, right answer. But she was a film major. She loved movies. She loved writing. You know, she, her future was going to be in the arts, I believe. She also, you know, as we've said earlier, she was an advocate for people of all stripes. She was, she never judged anybody. She never judged anybody. You know, she made friends with cool people, regardless of their background or their orientation or anything about them. She was just a kind of she had a broad kind of way of making friends and being friends with people. What else, Vanessa?
Hey, sorry. I'm a blood vessel just popped in my eye and it hurts right now. So give me a minute. Sorry. It's a form of stress that I've had for a while. And when it hurts right now. So I'm sorry. You can keep talking, Joe. I'll chime in in a minute.
Okay. Well, I hope you feel better.
Thank you.
She just texted me a picture. That looks awful.
Well, and I have to lean my head back, otherwise it fills my whole eye and it looks like I'm a demon.
Well,
sorry, that's oversharing with your audience. I'm so sorry, Zachary.
No, you're fine. Don't worry. I'll edit this part out too. This won't obviously be a part of the actual episode itself, but yeah, Joe, you can continue talking about, you know, like, future aspirations for Megan and talk more about, like, what interests her about film and just kind of, like, you know, lead into that.
Yeah, she was, she loved whodunits. She loved campy comedies. You know, she and I watched Knives Out together over 40 times, if you can believe that. We would be, when Vanessa and I were still together, we'd be sitting on the couch watching Knives Out, and Vanessa would walk through the living room and be like, again? We'd be like, hell yeah, again.
Yeah, but my movie like that with Megan was My Cousin Vinny. So
right,
she had that with everybody that was special to her. You know, everybody had their favorite movie that she watched, and everybody thought that was her very favorite movie.
She when she decided to be a film major, I was over the moon. I didn't I and I didn't have any influence on her making that decision. That was all her. So I before she went to school, we watched as many movies as I could think of. I mean, everything that I thought she might need for film school, and she just ate it up. But she was taking screenwriting, photography, film classes, basically all the kind of stuff to prepare her for some kind of career around film, I would think. She was writing film reviews. She and I watched. And she needed some Gen X. She was a big grunge fan, among other things. But one night we watched Singles and Reality Bites, and she loves Singles as from my opinion, she should. But then we watched Reality Bites, and she said, "God, that movie was terrible." And I said, "Yes, I don't know why people think it's a classic." So she ended up for a class, she had to write a review of a movie, and she wrote just a scathing review of Reality Bites. And I was very happy about that. Very proud of her. I don't know where she would have ended up, but she was an extremely creative person, extremely intelligent. I think her creative side would have come through in whatever she did.
Yeah, the classes she was taking that last semester, she was so excited about. One of them was photography. She got a really nice camera for Christmas. She was also doing screenwriting. And I don't remember the other two off the top of my head. I can look them up, but they were all classes that she was just so excited about.
Which whenever
And
we think about, oops, sorry, go ahead, Joe.
she was having fun. I told her before she went to college, I was like, "Megan, you are gonna kill it in college. You are a prototypical college student, opinionated, too smart for your own good, creative, a little bit lazy." I was like, "Once you get to college, you're gonna explode, And she did, and she was really enjoying it. And she would send us texts to that effect saying, "College rules. I love college. I'm having so much fun with my classes and I'm meeting new people." And she had reunited with one of her friends from elementary school who she saw on campus. All that kind of builds that foundation of if you look at signs of suicide, there was nothing there, she was really enjoying her life. And I think she would, one of the things that kind of breaks my heart is wherever she is now, I'm sure she's disappointed that she didn't get to live it all the way out,
Oh.
Absolutely. What are some of the other inconsistencies that you believe and that, well, a lot of people believe, that this the police department definitely dropped the ball on this case? What are some of those other inconsistencies outside of the ones that you mentioned earlier? What else have you noticed? What do you hear on social media? What are you hearing community members say? What are you hearing like her friends say? Because her roommate was one of the last people to see her alive, right?
Right.
So what are you hearing like community members saying whenever you initially came forward with the story? What are you hearing community members say?
Well, I think universally, anybody who looks at the evidence, and I say this with a grain of salt, we have a lot of supporters, a lot of people who care about us, and care about how we're doing. So, you kind of have to filter that through. But anybody who reads through the case or who talks to Vanessa and I, it's like there's no way she killed herself. And furthermore, anybody who we take up to that spot, and we've taken a lot of people up there to the spot where her body was found, once you go up there and you see where they say she went, everybody unanimously says there is no way. This just does not work. That's really the big thing. I mean, universally people, anybody who knew her, anybody who's known our family says there's no way that she took her own life. I mean, the exception is her roommate. her roommate initially told police that she didn't think Megan would take her own life, but then her story has evolved over time. We tend to stay away from that, just because it's a dead end for us to engage with the roommate. There is the events that occurred that night are problematic in that Megan was in the dorm with her boyfriend. The roommate was at work. The roommate knew that Megan and her boyfriend would be in the room. The roommate had an
A 15-minute
irrational,
break?
huh?
A 15-minute break. Oh, sorry. I thought you were going with the story. Go ahead. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that, the roommate knew that Megan and her boyfriend were going to be in the dorm. The roommate had this irrational boundary that Megan couldn't have sex in her dorm room. And it bears stating that Vanessa and I are progressive. I mean, Megan's in college. She can have sex. I mean, that's when you do all that. That's, you're becoming a person. And the roommate took a break from work and came home, and caught them in the room, had an argument with Vanessa, with Megan. And then Megan's boyfriend didn't like the drama, so he told Megan that he wanted to take a break, which upset her. I mean, she was definitely emotionally compromised by that, but not to the point where she would walk up Boulder Canyon, take all of her Adderall, and lay down and die. As her sister said, Megan would never kill herself over a boy, and I truly believe that. But so the roommate situation, she said a lot of things on Reddit. She did an interview with People Magazine that we believe had some inconsistencies, but I don't know. I mean, that's about as far as I can go on that.
I want to add just another piece to it is that the roommate never once reached out while Megan was missing. She didn't help with the search. She didn't help hang flyers. None of that. Megan's boyfriend, on the other hand, was absolutely there every day. He was knocking on businesses where he saw cameras looking for video footage. It's two very different responses to our family and to Megan while she was missing. And I think that speaks volumes,
I think it definitely does speak volumes. And did anybody notice? Because typically, if somebody dies by suicide, there's different signs, right? It doesn't sound like Megan was exhibiting any of those signs. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't point directly to that. And that's not to say like every single, case of suicide is the exact same, because we know it's not. It's very complex, right? But there wasn't any like signs of literally any of that based on what, I've researched, basically what I know and what I'm hearing. There was no signs,
No.
like that's another inconsistency with this. And I can't get past like how they found Megan. I can't get past that. During your pre-interview, you touched on and you mentioned like how she was found. Would you be okay with talking about that now? Because that's a key point in all of this.
Yes, like the positioning of her body. Yes. So mind you, this I've only seen a drawing of what it was, because I obviously do not want to actually see the images of how they found her. She was laying in a prone position. That means she was on her back, wearing the same things that she was seen leaving on the doorman, but her head was pushed way back, so her neck was like in line with her chest. But even more so, like it, her neck, her head was pushed very far back. Her pant legs were bunched up like around her knees or closer to her knees. Her left arm was outstretched, and Her sleeve was ripped, by the way. So you know all of these signs of some kind of struggle, you know, that she was in a physical altercation with someone else are very obvious to me, right? Like, you know, paradoxical in dressing, they mentioned that in one of the reports. Who nobody paradoxically undresses and rips the seam to their left jacket off of their arm. And it's a well-made jacket. I think Joe said it was Levi's that
Yeah,
she.
it's a Levi's like synthetic denim jacket that I bought for myself and she stole from me as she did. She was kind of off topic, but man, when we were going through her things after we got all of her stuff back, I found like 10 of my shirts that she had taken. I'm like, oh my God, that's where that was. Anyway, I'm sorry, Vanessa, go ahead.
So our left arm outstretched, right? Her arm was through the rip. And then that sleeve was like placed over her neck and her face, almost like a scarf. She had all of these injuries, right? Like if she had fallen on her face in those rocks and broken her teeth from hitting her face on those rocks, her face would have been shredded. I mean, the rocks are very jagged and it was icy. Like that's a north-facing slope, so the ice there doesn't melt. It stays until it gets warm enough to melt. She had abrasions on her back that I've heard can be described as looking like she was dragged across something. And then positioned perfectly underneath her were this pair of small sweatpants. And Megan liked to wear her clothes big, you know, like that when Billie Eilish went through that phase. I don't know if she still dresses like that, but Megan likes her clothes big and comfortable for the most part. She didn't own anything small. Those pants that were under her were also just filthy, from what I understand. And I don't, it's baffling to me because when you look at what they submitted into evidence or what they kept as evidence, they said Megan Trussell's pants. Those are not Megan Trussell's pants. Nobody even asked, nor did they even test them to see if Megan's DNA was on them or if there was somebody else's or where the dirt that was on them came from. So going back to the whole, took a bunch of Adderall, found this weird spot that you have to know is there because you can't find it in the dark. And laid down and put her head back so far that it was uncomfortable, and all that stuff started coming back up, right? Like, if she really took that herself, her body would be rejecting it and she would be vomiting. That's if she was conscious, right? When that was put into her body. They also don't know if it was put in there post-mortem. Like, it was a very unnatural position that her neck was in. So, they don't want to release the autopsy, the official autopsy photos. They told us you can go ahead and have an independent forensic pathologist go through the autopsy, but just the reports. So I have those, and I've been reading through some of them as best I can. Some of it's a little too difficult to read, but the bias is very obvious in those reports as well, you know. In fact, they have a log of every time I called, and they basically are calling me this hysterical mom who hangs up on them all the time. And you know, I did hang up on them a few times because when I would call to ask for something, they would be very condescending and dismissive. And there was one person in particular in all of her, it was her that I mostly hung up on. And then I would just call back until I got somebody else who would actually look at the pictures and give me answers. Like I wanted to know if the foot that didn't have a shoe had any injuries on it. And she told me no, and which is a lie because there are injuries on that foot. She keeps it very narrow and, you know, so that she's not lying. She said she looked at the x-rays and there were no broken bones. They did a full body x-ray scan, no broken bones. Yeah, but so many injuries. Like it was two pages of injuries on the autopsy report. How is that suicide? Well, and then just eventually dying from hypothermia. with a bunch of Adderall in your stomach, supposedly.
I was gonna say, because you know what, there's this list of injuries that's inconsistent with suicide in itself. And injuries like what you're describing doesn't just happen by itself. This is something that, you know, comes from like blunt force trauma or something that is done by somebody else. This isn't
Right.
something that is consistent with suicide literally at all. Anybody who knows anything about mental health and suicide prevention, you don't have to be an expert on it. You just have to know the basic concept. And anybody who knows this type of advocacy work knows that this is inconsistent with suicide. And I'm sitting here and I'm checking like these red flags, like, and they're going off like crazy because it's like, this makes zero sense. And I think anybody who does the research, it makes zero sense. It's not adding up. It's inconsistent. And Joe, whenever you were talking about, we were talking about earlier about you had somebody kind of like look over and such, and you know how they said that this is a very messy report. And I have to agree. This is very, you know, and excuse my language, but this is very fucked up. It really is. And there's nothing right about this literally at all. And it doesn't make any sense. It makes zero sense at all.
And the you know the gaslighting began pretty early on. We or Vanessa constantly was asking the coroner's office and the sheriff, you know, when are we going to find out the cause and manner of death? When are we going to find out cause and manner of death? I mean, I think Vanessa, you started like the first week in March asking that question. And they kept saying, we're waiting for toxicology. Toxicology can take months. We're waiting for toxicology. The lab's backed up. We're waiting for toxicology. The Boulder County Sheriff or the DA, I can't remember, told our attorney that they were waiting for toxicology, so they didn't have cause and manner of death. Well, after we had the meeting and they said it was suicide, and then we had a meeting with the coroner and the forensic pathologist, he offered to send us the toxicology report. When we got the toxicology report, the date at the top of the report was March 9th. So they had it the whole time, and they lied and lied and lied week to week about why they were waiting to do this. And we have a theory that, you know, this is a CU student. They didn't want to cause any hysteria, so they waited to make the announcement until after school was out because the dates line up. But, you know, just more signs of an incomplete, insufficient, inaccurate investigation.
Which they know. So, connecting back to the autopsy, right? We started a new GoFundMe. The last GoFundMe, we're calling that phase one, which actually the majority of that money was used for cremation services. I mean, it was started by my niece Rebecca, initially when we were looking for her, like to feed volunteers, to make copies, to put flyers out there. And then once her body was found and recovered, it shifted to, you know, having a memorial service for her, which had more than 300 people. Actually, was it 400, Joe? We thought it was going to be 300 and ended up being like 400.
Yeah, we estimated 300, but it was over 400, which was cool. I mean, in the universe we live in, it's cool. I mean, we did what I consider, I thought we did a great job with her memorial service.
We did. We really did. Rebecca made a beautiful video of all her memories and played Island in the Sun by Weezer, and just
Yeah,
one
we
of
have.
Megan's songs. Lindsay wrote a poem. I mean, so yeah, the GoFundMe covered a lot of that. And then it helped pay for the initial, while we were looking, when we realized the phone was missing, we bought like scope cameras. I've looked inside every single rock that's anywhere within a 20-foot radius of where her body was found because I was looking for that phone or for her earbuds or, you know, anything that was hers that maybe fell under the in between the rocks.
Because the detective told us that he believed the phone was up there. Just wanted to throw that in there.
And as a reminder, it was not. Our friend Beverly, she's as relentless as me. She has the same birthday as me, by the way. She was up there, and you know, she'd get off work as a nurse, and She would go around to the people in the unhoused community and ask them, "Where? What would you do with a phone? If you found a phone, what would you do with it?" And one of the guys told her, "You know what? People would sell it over there at the Eco ATM at King Soopers." So she immediately went over there. It was down at the time, so she talked to the manager, and he said, "Oh no, it's just been down since yesterday." So she got me all the information, and I filed a report, I filed a claim. And 2 days later, I get an email that says, "Congratulations, we found your device." So, interestingly enough, right at that time, we had hired a lawyer because we were being stonewalled, gaslit, just not treated with any level of respect or dignity. And
Yeah, I thought that, after kind of going back to when Vanessa posted the information on Facebook and the sheriff immediately came out and said, no foul play, no danger to the community. I told Vanessa, we need a lawyer because we're now in an adversarial relationship with these people. They are not advocating for us. So we need somebody who can. So that's when we hired the attorney. Anyway, sorry, Vanessa, just wanted to throw that in
yeah.
there.
And so, I mean, that's where the bulk of the money from the first GoFundMe has gone, for those things. Because lawyers aren't cheap, even though we don't want to get into the weeds, but that was the first part, right? And now we're trying to run our own investigation. We're going to have to do, I'm learning that I can't trust that they're going to do any testing. There's a whole ton of ego in that in Boulder. And I don't think anybody is willing to admit any wrongdoing or any, I mean, I'd like to give them the benefit of the doubt and not think it was malicious. Instead, it's just more that they want to protect their brand and their name, but it feels malicious to me at this point. And I really think they're going to dig their heels in. They're never going to, I think right now the coroner has information that he's sitting on because I asked him to get the quantities of Adderall or what was in her stomach quantified. Okay, so you put this big 1.7 million nanograms out there. Why don't you ask them what that really means? That was 2 weeks ago, maybe three. And he said he sent it in. I sent a follow-up asking if he has gotten it back, and it's radio silence, crickets, because I think he knows, and I think there's a lot of pressure that, the sheriff does not want him to change that ruling because then that means that they were wrong. So, the coroner is now in this, at least this is my thinking. It feels like he is in a moral conundrum. Does he want to do the right thing? Does he want to admit that they were wrong? And that means going against his buddy, the sheriff, right? They're all, elected officials together. They all back each other or don't back each other. The current coroner is actually, he's the replacement for the previous coroner, who was fired for having a toxic environment in the coroner's office. So this is what he's having to overcome, right? So something that we're trying to make so public for him to come out and say the quantity of Adderall doesn't fit what the forensic pathologist made the assumption on. He's going to have to go against what she's saying, and she's pretty adamant about it. She's also very smug. We actually recorded our conversation with them, and I've shared it with a few people, and people just can't believe that the way they talk to us and just the dismissiveness and, trying to hide behind pseudoscience or, their guesses when they're just
Yeah.
guesses. They need to
She
really come out and say, we guessed and are bad.
the forensic pathologist, there was, I mean, to kind of distill it down, I had questions about the narrative. Okay, well you say this based on your examination, but none of this adds up. And she basically said, "That's not my job." Question after question. "Well, what about this?" "Well, that's, yeah, I'm not going to speculate. That's not my job." However, to Vanessa's point, I think the coroner, I mean, I like everybody, but I think he's a good dude. He needs a shot of courage, but I think he knows, honestly, simply by the way that he's treated us, which is with, or treated Vanessa, which is with respect. I think there's some good in him. Remains to be seen if we can get anywhere.
But we also have to keep in mind we're fighting, we're battling a system, right? Through our lawyer, they, because she requested the autopsy, like all the files and the photos, we went through the process of me becoming Megan's legal representative, which meant that Joe and lawyer and Megan's sister had to say that they didn't want that and they were willing to get over. Like, it's a whole process. You don't just declare it, it's a legal proceeding. So they were happy that I did that. So they gave me the autopsy reports, like the official files that all have stamped across them confidential, but they are absolutely refusing to release photos. And their reasoning for that is because they, out of respect for Megan, that they don't want that to end up on media, like in the news. Or newspapers, like as if to say that Joe and I would be okay with that, like the one of us or me specifically, since I'm the one who has the legal right, but like that I'm gonna do that. It's absurd to me that they somehow believe that they respect Megan in death more than I do. And that's their reasoning, right? Which is absolutely absurd and it's disrespectful to say that. So the lawyer is, she suggested that we could have a forensic pathologist go and look, our own, independent person go and look at the photos on their site. Well, think about that, right? Like that's just one more roadblock they're trying to put in our way, right? Like that limits, do we have money to fly in a forensic pathologist to go to Boulder County Coroner's office and sit there with them all watching over his shoulder or her shoulder and look at these photos? By the way, they haven't said that they would allow that either, right? But if you have to fly someone in from another state, because honestly, it's pretty hard to find somebody who will go against Dr. Meredith Frank in Colorado. She is also, she runs the fellowship program, I think, at CU. Anschutz. And I had reached out to a few people early on who said, "Oh, no, I can't. She was my supervising pathologist," or she, she has her hands in everything. She does. We're actually pulling statistics for her right now. She does autopsies in Denver, Summit County, Boulder, and I think there's two more. So we're requesting statistics on that. There are very, very few in Denver that she's done. Denver actually sent that sent this, those statistics like the next day. And she doesn't like to say anything is undetermined. It's a very small percentage. And in future Facebook posts, because I have a whole plan for Facebook posts to keep to keeping people engaged and keeping people angry. Because what we're gearing up for, what we're ramping up for is a legal battle, and as I said, nobody can make a coroner change their determination, except for maybe if he wants to get reelected. So how do you fight that battle? Well, it's going to have to be in the media. It's going to have to be public. It's going to have to be people saying you shouldn't have that job if you can't do that job. But that's like, people in Boulder County are the ones who are going to have to make that vote. And that's not for another how many years? 2, 3 years? I don't know how long he has left in that term, but that's it's, we're in a long battle. And if we have to take them to court, which is really what this second wave of the GoFundMe is for, is gearing up for that, right? Like we need to have more, we already have one forensic pathologist, who's willing to go on record We have hired a forensic toxicologist who is finishing up his report right now, ready to go on record. The lawyer would like, because she's a really good lawyer and she does really well in court, and she wants to have another forensic pathologist, perhaps a more well-known one, to go on record. And none of these things are cheap. Her time isn't cheap, her research isn't cheap, and that's the path we're going to have to go to get justice for Megan, because the bottom line is, as long as it's a suicide, nobody is going to reopen this case. Nobody's going to look into any of the contradictions in the investigation. In fact, Dr. or not Dr. Senator Janice Marchman had reached out to the current Boulder DA, asking him to just investigate the investigation. And he responded in and he's relying all on the coroner's report. Is, how did he word that, Joe? The coroner's report is substantial, or is like has a lot of holds a lot of weight,
Right.
because it's a suicide. Like that, he says it's a suicide. So there's no, like, why would they go investigate? Why would they send anything in for toxicology or for forensic testing? I mean, he said it's a suicide. All the bottles, specifically, the DA said all the bottles. Once again, another person who knows nothing about this medication, and the fact that Megan didn't throw anything away. Well, she never threw her bottles away. There were six more in her room when I cleaned it out.
Oh yeah, that did we mention that, the bottles that were found in her dorm room?
I don't know. I don't remember. We,
Don't think so.
we tell the story so much that it's hard to remember. But yeah, I mean, that was their narrative, right? Like every single deputy or whoever's writing a report, they all start with the there. So there were actually three bottles that were like kind of out where people could see them. And then they found a fourth bottle that was like under her bed in a drawer that, like, I don't even know why that one should count, obviously. And there, it was like August, September, October, November were the bottles. And she took them. She took it almost every day for school. So to think that she was just stockpiling these bottles of Adderall, is absolutely ridiculous. The other thing is that in the stomach contents, there is no description of the bright orange casings that those pills come in. So back to the getting back to the DA, like he's not going to, nobody's going to investigate anything. And what I really would like to happen, like in a, well, as Joe says, in a perfect world, somebody's just going to come out and admit it, right? But even if somebody did right now, it's a suicide. So they could say they did it and nothing would happen, because they would, if they were taken to court, or if they were, somebody tried to press charges, well, they just have to say, well, the coroner said it was a suicide. So I didn't, obviously, I didn't do that, even if I said I did. So that has to be changed in order for anybody to reinvestigate. And I don't want Boulder County to reinvestigate. With the Ellen Greenberg case, her parents have spent $700,000 over 11, 12 years. They finally had, in a civil court, they finally got that police agency to say that they would reopen the case and have a private or an independent autopsy review done. Then the whoever it was dragged their feet for a long time, and then they finally came out and said, well, they never started investigating again, by the way, because why would they, right? Like, there's so much ego. I don't want Boulder County. Once this suicide ruling gets changed, I don't want Boulder County to investigate anything, because they're not going to look for anything. They're going to do the same crappy job they did the first time. So it needs to be Colorado Bureau of Investigation or some other agency. I don't know who that might be, but that's the only way that any of this is going to make any kind of progress. And in order to do that, it's going to take investigating on our on like by us. And finding experts who are willing to go on record and who aren't afraid of, Boulder County Sheriff. And then ultimately it's going to have to go in the media, I think. because there's too much ego involved for anybody to admit that they did a half-assed job and that they were biased against Megan.
I have to agree. I think, raising a lot of media awareness, obviously we get media to cover it. Now that's a whole different that's a whole different story, right? But I think, I have this movement of 200,000 plus people that are following this movement, and I want to use it in the greatest way possible. So, what is a way that people can help contribute to your investigation? I know there's a GoFundMe, there's a petition, there's a number of different ways, there's Facebook groups, things like that. What are ways that people can amplify this investigation and Megan's story in the best way possible, including myself, because like I said, I want to use this movement to amplify these efforts and use it to the best advantage. That's the reason why I created the movement, is to be a voice and to be a thorn in the authority side. And how do we amplify your messages?
Yeah, I mean, I think just getting the story out there, spreading the story, keeping the story in the public eye with broad-reaching audiences, Joe and I do like two or three interviews a week. And while it's emotionally exhausting, and like we said, we're both full-time professionals. I'm an elementary school principal, and my job, I love my school community, and actually they give me so much strength to do all of this work, and they have the patience for when I, take an hour out of the middle of my workday to do an interview. But for people to still want to hear us, for people reaching out and asking for interviews, that, I mean, we're going to keep doing them as hard as it is and as, emotionally taxing as it is. We have a goal, and Joe and I are very driven people, and we're not going to stop. And people reaching out, people's suggestions. If somebody knows a professional or like an expert who might be able to contribute to this and can reach out to them on our behalf, that would be great. I think the more we get the story out there, the more people who might come forward who might know a path or an avenue to get this case looked at, to get the case reinvestigated.
Well, yeah, and there's an $11,000 reward for any information that leads to an arrest. So, on a more foundational level, if there's anybody out there, as we spread the word, if somebody saw something, if somebody knows something, maybe somebody's afraid to come forward, somebody had to have seen something because she didn't vanish into thin air. And it was Super Bowl Sunday. And even though it was cold, there were people out. So if anybody knows anything, the broader we can get this out here, if it ends up, affecting the Boulder community in some way, and somebody has some information, then, my pipe dream of having somebody, getting some evidence that leads us away from all this legal wrangling and having to deal with the coroner and the sheriff and all that kind of stuff. If we can get something that way, that would just be, a blessing.
Yeah, agreed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. 100%. Joe and Vanessa, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. And I admire your courage, and I admire the strength that both of you have, because as you said, this is very emotionally taxing and it's very draining, but at the same time, you're driven. And you're driven by something that unfortunately a lot of families understand. And it's not a community that anybody wants to be a part of, but I also feel that it could be a way of healing as well, being around people who get it and they see through the bullshit. And Joe, I want to actually say that you remind me a lot of myself in the way that you talk and the way that you explain things, because I do it in a non-PG way, because You have to. You know, these are deep emotions that run deep, right? And this is a very traumatic and very, this is a deep tragedy. And it's not only a tragedy for you, but also a tragedy for the community because of who Megan could have been. You know, and my mind goes in 40,000 different directions whenever I hear a story like this, but this one really hits home for me because this is a lot. And I know if it's a lot for me to listen to, I can't imagine what it's like for both of you to share it time and time again. But again, I want to say thank you for coming on the podcast today. And I will continue amplifying as much as I can because I have a community that is willing to listen. And to anybody out there, please be sure to follow on social media Justice for Megan. And it will also be in our bio on our story whenever this episode releases. And it will be everywhere. And as well as the petition and the GoFundMe will also be on our website and our social media. So with that, Joe and Vanessa, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. I greatly appreciate both of you and know that my heart is with you through this entire process.
Well, thank you
Thank
very
you.
much for having us. We appreciate it. And we appreciate all the support that we've received and continue to receive from everybody from close friends to complete strangers. It's been extremely overwhelming, and I just can't tell you how much we appreciate it.
Absolutely.
And we really wouldn't have come this far without all of the support we feel and have. So
Agreed.
thank you. Thank you, Zachary.
Absolutely. You both have the best day that you possibly can have. And please also take care of yourselves because, again, we live in a very dark world right now. Please take care of both of yourselves, and I look forward to continuing the conversation.
Thanks.
Thank you.